on chapter 38, sentence 39. It is page 1673. Doesn't feel like we've read 1672 pages. Some weeks. So, last time round, we saw the first half of God's first speech to Job. Right after the previous week in which we had introduced it and talked about what God is trying to achieve with Job and what the core goal of this speech is. And we talked about it as a speech which is not meant to say, Job, I'm wonderful and you are not, as much as it's meant to highlight the distance between God's world and Job's world, so that when Job asks for communication and demands a connection, God is saying to him, it doesn't work that way. There is no possibility of a true connection and a true communication, because our worlds are just entirely different. And the first half of the speech spoke about that in terms of creation and control of the universe and things that God spends his time on and the knowledge that God has. But now he shifts gears to talk about the wild kingdom, the wild beasts. And there are, as I outlined at the end last time, three different approaches that I'd like to highlight to this section. One approach, which is the traditional approach to it, is that this is meant to show how much more God can do than human beings can do. But I feel like that's missing the boat in the reading of this speech. The second approach, which is my own thought, is that it's meant to show the ways in which God takes care of the animals without communicating with them, because that is analogous to God's control of the world of human beings. In other words, God is going to describe how he looks after the young of the wild goat. And he's going to describe how he feeds the, or brings prey to the lion and to the raven and so forth. And there's no communication between God and beast. So too with human beings. So I'll take care of you, but don't expect me to talk to you, Job. That's a second possible read. And then the third approach, which was Newsom's approach, we read it from her text last time, is to say that it's really about what I called before the difference between our world and God's world, in the sense that you can divide the world between the civilized and the chaotic. Human beings inhabiting the so-called civilized world, what we think of as civilization, and then you have the animals that are out in the wild. And what God does in the speech to Job here is to associate himself not with civilization, which is what we would have thought, but rather God will associate himself instead with the chaotic, the wild, the frightening. That's what we're going to see here. And the message that it sends is sort of, God is actually with the wild animals. He's not with you. You think he's on your side. He's not. And it also is going to highlight sort of the superfluity of human beings. The fact that we're not really so necessary. Because the things that we take pride in, that which we do for the domesticated animals, God takes care of it for the wild animals. And if we weren't there to take care of our sheep, and we weren't there to take care of our cows, so God will do it. He would do that too. It's not as though the human being should take pride in what he's doing, because the reality is that God's doing all of this, and he's doing it for the scarier creatures that are out there. So there's that element to this too. It's a little bit complex. We'll see better, I think, once we've actually gone through the verses themselves. Let's launch into it, please. Or not. Janine.
Isn't that third approach? Which you maybe fleshed out a little more than last week. Isn't that contrary to Jewish thought that the world was created for man? He should be nigra olam, that man is at the center of the whole point, is the perfection of man. I mean, it's kind of a, I assume it's a Christian attitude. I don't see it as
a So it's an interesting question, but Rav Sadia Gaon would be very insulted. I'm sorry, not Rav Sadia Gaon, the Rambam would be very insulted. Rav Sadia Gaon would be fine with what you just said. But the Rambam would be very insulted. Meaning, the debate about anthropocentricity, the debate about is the world really about human beings, is a very old debate. Even you can trace it to the Gemara itself. when on the one hand, the Gemara talks about perfection and malachim as being close to God, and then on the other hand, there's another passage in the Gemara which says that the angels can only praise God once human beings do. They have to wait for us, and then they're able to sing to God. The question fundamentally could even be reduced to, is perfection the ideal, or is growth the ideal? Meaning, you can look at the world and say, we're not perfect as human beings. Angels must be much more satisfying to God, because they, you know, generally speaking, with a few midrashim that we'll just ignore, don't make mistakes. But we could look at the world and say that, and human beings, on the other hand, you know, we're one big disappointment. On the other hand, the response could be that that's what God values in us. The fact that we triumph over the disappointment. It's actually this week's Toronto Torah, I wrote the Parsha article, is going to sort of focus on this. I'm taking, you know, yet another masochistic attempt to explain the phenomenon of Baal Mum, why it is that a Kohen is not able to serve in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, if he has a physical defect, which is so strange in the context of Judaism as a whole, which preaches over and over again in so many different contexts that you're not supposed to look at a person's physical wholeness or disability, that we're supposed to look out for and protect the vulnerable and certainly not stigmatize them. There are so many, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Moshe Rabbeinu would have been disqualified as a Kohen because he has a mum. You know, I mean, you think about how strange the whole thing is. So what I suggested, but this doesn't exempt you from having to read the article. But what I suggested there is that the Kohen is understood to be the Shaliach of Hashem. He's Shluchei DeRachmana. He's God's agent. There's even a pasuk in Malachi which calls him a Malach. About the Kohen. Sifsei Kohen Yishmeru Das, Torah Mevakshu Mifiyu, etc. Malach Hashem Tzvakosu. The Kohen is a Malach of God. I mean, he's supposed to represent God. And if he's going to represent God, so then he has to be unblemished. But our role models are the blemished people. When it comes to human achievement, our role models are the people who are blemished and who then succeed. To take it into another plane, there's this great debate, which I'm going to mention, but I'm not going to allow any questions on, which is the David and Bathsheba debate. Meaning the question of, did David sin or not? You have the famous Gemara in Shabbos, which says, nope, anybody who says David sinned is simply mistaken. That's one view there in the Gemara. But then on the other hand, you have a Gemara in Avodah Zarah which says that David sinned, and we learn tshuva from that, from David's incident. Well, the wording of Tanakh is that he sinned. The explicit wording of it. Yeah, no, Nasan HaNavi says, you know, yeah, you did it. And no, I'm sorry, Nasan says, you're the man, and David says, I sinned. And then the Gemara Shabbos says, no, you didn't. But that debate fundamentally is because you have a pasuk that says that Hashem was with David in all of his ways. Later pasuk. And so the Gemara in Shabbos says, can it be that God would have been with David if he had done such a terrible thing? Impossible. It must be that he didn't really do what it sounds like he did. That's one tack that says perfection is the ideal. The other tack of the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, no, there is such a thing as sin and there's such a thing as tshuva. And if a person's tshuva is real, then yes, God will be with them. It's the same debate, fundamentally, about the human being. Is it arrogant for human beings who are flawed to say, we are the center and we are the purpose? Or are we the center and the purpose because we are flawed, and the point is for us to achieve more? So if Sajagon...
We're the purpose. I'm the center. I understand the saying that they're as important as you. I mean, just go back to Bereshit, man is supposed to...
No, but it's not so. It's not so. In other words, the one view is that God values the one who is flawed and yet achieves. And according to that school of thought, yes, we are the center. But if you take the school of thought that says you have to be perfect, and that there's a hierarchy, and the more perfect you are, the more satisfied God is with you, then we're not even on the scale, because you have all these tiers of servants of God, of malachim, who don't sin at all. And so you have, just to close the thread, I'm not going back to the David and Bathsheba thing, just saying that. You're not the one I'm talking to. on this score. But the point is that Rav Sajagon says the fact that we have free will demonstrates that we are critical to the universe and we are the ones for whom the world was created. Bishvili nivra ha'olam, to take that line, the world's created for me. And it's a healthy thing for a human being to think that way, as long as they have the thing in their other pocket saying, and I am dust and ash. But that's one school of thought. The Rambam says no. The Rambam says this is hubris. Human beings are not the purpose of the world. We have a purpose. But the divine plan is much grander, and it includes in it many more elements that have nothing to do with human beings whatsoever. The tree frog in the middle of the Amazon, who will never meet a human being, whose ancestors never met a human being, and whose descendants will never meet a human being, nonetheless is significant to God's plan. He's not simply there because that's what the world's supposed to look like. There's a role and a goal for all that exists according to the Rambam, and no, it's not about us. These are two very solid schools of thought. And that's my sense of it. Ralph?
The emphasis on perfection is I'm asking the question, is much more Christian than it is Jewish. Our thrust isn't really in that direction. It is more to improve ourselves, but certainly not perfect.
I think we like it. We like that approach because it's, you know, friendlier, so to speak. It's less scary than demanding perfection. I'm not sure that makes it more authentic.
If we look at this past week's parsha, and I recognize holy kedusha is different than perfection.
Yeah.
So she to you, not a tempter. You should strive. It's something to strive for. It's not something that you are innate. You're not innate, by the way. You strive for kedusha.
I'm not sure that that's the way to read to you, as the Hebrew word. No, I mean, it's nice as a homiletic. I'm just, as a literal read, to you is you shall be. It's an imperative.
But it doesn't mean that you are at the moment.
Well, by dint of your behavior. So whatever behavior you engage in, you shall be, or you shall demonstrate, I guess, holiness. I'm not convinced by the word to you. I mean, you can make arguments for both sides and be right. I don't think this is one of those questions that has an answer. But I do think that's the correct way to read this chapter. In other words, I think God is very clear. You'll see as we go through it. He's very clear that he's on the side of the wild animals. That the wild animals who have nothing to do with human beings, just like in the previous chapter, he said, I bring rain on desolate land where nothing, you know, where there is never a human being. You know, he's saying, this isn't all about you, Job. The world is a much bigger place, and it isn't all about human beings. That's my sense of it, but again, you have both sides. But yeah, I wouldn't condemn it as a Christian perspective. I think there's an awful lot within Judaism to recommend it. The first place where I saw this debated was an article by Dr. Norman Lamb on alien life, extraterrestrial life. And so he was discussing it in the terms of the question of, philosophically, within Judaism, would it bother me if there was some other race out there, you know, that had some other mission that had nothing to do with Jews and humanity? And he said, it depends on which view you take. If you take the view that we are the center of the universe, then there must be some way in which they're involved with us, or else why would they exist? But if you take the view that it's not all about us, so okay, so there's some other world where something else is going on, and God is amused by them. It's an interesting discussion, not simple and straightforward. Okay, but let's go back to Job. We're at, again, chapter 38, sentence 39. The beginning of the second half of God's first speech, as I just prefaced before the other preface. So, after discussing the universe and knowledge of the universe, he then turns to these beasts, and he starts with the lion and the raven.
You kept saying last week you're going to go back to a bunch of stuff. Are you going to go back to it?
I don't remember what I said I was going to go back to, so the odds are no. No, that's not true.
The language and stuff that you rushed through.
Yeah. No, I said I'm not coming back to language. I said I'm skipping language. But yes. Yes. No. Anything that if I say I'm coming back to it, then I am. Yeah. I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. The But I am skipping a lot of linguistic notes in the interest of getting through this. Do you, Job, do you catch prey for the lioness? Do you fill the needs of the kfir, the young lion? Do you support the lions, Job? Ki yashochu bameonos, when they crouch in ambush in their lairs. Yashuvu basukalam o'are, yeshvu basukalam o'are, they sit in sukkah, sukkah not meaning sukkah, sukkah meaning shelter. They sit in the shelter in ambush. So tell me, do you take care of them? So I was a little bit bothered as I read this, because they're laying in ambush, right? What is God doing? They're predators. What do you mean God brings them prey? So Metzudat David explains, if you take a look at source number 2 on your sheet. Number 1, I just gave you an outline of the different animals so that the structure would be a little, hopefully, more clear. But in number 2, he says, Halo anina sadi chochma bahima limso teref. He says, I invested wisdom in the animal for them to find prey. In other words, I made them a predator. I gave them the ability to do this. Asher yichpafu komasam b'meduram, they huddle in their lairs. Lebal yergishu b'machayos v'yivrchu, lest the wild beast sense them and flee. God is saying, I gave them the instincts that they use in order to hunt. And back in Pasuk Mem Aleph, sentence 41, the same thing regarding the raven. Mi yachina la'orev tzedo. Who prepares the prey, or the food, for the raven? Ki yiladav el kel yishaveyu. Its young cry out to God, yis'u livlo ochel. They would wander without food. And they need the support that I give them. So first of all, human beings pride themselves on providing food for their animals. Who does it for the wild animals? That would be me, capital M. Yes?
It's almost like the justification of the food chain or the animal chain, or the little one, particularly until we get to the humans. This is almost like I made the lion to eat the prey, and the raven to eat his prey, and it...
Well, he doesn't go into here the chain of it. In other words, I mean, it is implicit. Yes, I hear that. He then shifts from food to breeding. Another thing that we take pride in, the breeding of animals like sheep and goats. So God says, who does it for the wild goat? Perek Lamentes, chapter 39. This is another one of those chapter breaks where the chapter break just doesn't make sense. The original Christian breakup of the chapters doesn't explain itself, and we just have it, so we're stuck with it. But you could just easily have gone right into this. If I would have been breaking it up, I would have broken it up at the end of sentence 38, which is the break point between the first half and second half of the speech, when he shifts gears from talking about the universe to talking about animals. Nonetheless, Hayadata eis ledes yale sala choleal ayalos tishmor. Do you know when the wild goat is going to give birth? Choleal ayalot. Choleal, like chil kayoleda, these are birth tremors. The ayalot, ayala, is the heart, H-A-R-T. Some relative of deer and antelope and so on. So do you watch the time when they're going to give birth? Tispor yirachim timalena, sentence 2. Do you count the months till the gestation is full? Viadata eis lidatana, do you know when they give birth? Tichrana, they kneel, yaldehen tifalachna, and then the children come forth. Chevlehem tishalachna, they send forth these chavalim, the labor pangs. Yachlamu v'nehem, sentence 4. Their children become stronger. Yerbu vabar, they grow in bar, in the wilderness. Yatzu v'lo shavu lamo, they go out and they don't return. So this is the cycle of birth and raising children. And God says, what do you know about all of this? You're very proud of your animal husbandry, but you know it goes on without you. It goes on just fine without human beings.
Now, why we answer a question with a question?
Because God does.
God, yeah.
Yes, God likes to answer questions with questions, and they've never been more rhetorical than now. There's absolutely nothing that Job can respond to any of these questions until at the end of this chapter, God is going to put a question to him. We may even get to it today. The problem in this section, like in the previous section, is, so what exactly is it that God does in this? In other words, it's the animal that gives birth.
Set the wheel in motion.
Set the wheel in motion? Conception, you mean?
No, well, I mean, stuff that initial out of the creation.
The initial act of creation that led to this could be, sorry?
Yeah, but not to start the species.
Start the species going? Maybe. The answer could just be, it's not really about what God does. It's just saying, Job, you don't do it. There's an awful lot going on that human beings can't take credit for. You know, this is the wild side of things. But I brought you this very interesting passage in the Gemara in Bava Basra, source number 3, which assigns God a role. I didn't really look into this zoologically. If anybody wants to, you can do it for extra credit. But take a look at number 3. Ya'alazu achzarit al baneha. This wild deer is cruel to her children. When she kneels to give birth, she first goes up to the top of a mountain, that the young will fall from her and die. Not that this is intentionally so, but this is what it does. Before giving birth, it goes up to the top of the mountain, and the result is that the kid's going to die. V'ani mazmin la nesher. So I summon a nesher. I didn't translate nesher here. I've mentioned it before, that nesher likely is a vulture, but that's painful for people, so they render it as an eagle. But I took the art scroll route. I just translated it as nesher. So I summon a nesher to her. Shemekablo b'chnafa. It catches the young in its wings, umanicha lefaneha, and then places it before the mother. Ve'amali makdim rega echad o misacher rega echad. If this nesher would be a minute too early or a minute too late, miyad meis, the kid would die. Ben rega la rega la nischalifli, ben iov la oye nischalifli. The same refrain in the Gemara. You think I got confused that I'm judging the wrong guy? I got Iov confused with oye, Job for enemy. I don't get confused. That's part of the general school of thought that says this whole section is about divine might, so they're reading it that way. But I didn't bring it for that purpose. I brought it for the purpose of the opening part of this, which, you know, it says God's intervention is present in the case of the animal giving birth. I've never heard of any such thing. But if anyone wants to do research on the... there are very odd symbiotic relationships in nature. So maybe in some way the nesher benefits from doing it. You got me. Okay. That shows what I know about mountain goats. I'm in Job's camp in that regard. So that's your statement of feeding animals and breeding them. Now he moves on to taming wild animals. Pasuk Hey, sentence 5, and this is going to take us from sentence 5 through sentence 18. Mishilach perechovshi umosros arod mifiteach. Who sends the pere free? Pere is generally understood to be a wild donkey. Wild donkey is the normal translation. And the reins of the arod, which could be taken in a few different ways, but one standard translation is also along the lines of wild donkey. Who opens up the reins for these animals? In other words, who lets them roam free? Who gave them free rein in the wilderness? Asher samti arava veso, I have made the arava, the great plains, his home. Umishkenosav melecha, his home is the place of salt, which usually is viewed as a place of ruin, a place of desolation, but for this animal, that's home. And he does just fine. Yischak lahamon kirya, tishuos noges lo yishma. This is a great line. He laughs at the noise, the tumult of the city, and he never hears the cries of the oppressor. There's nobody who has tamed it, who has a whip to use against it. He laughs at the noise of the city. It's a funny sentence, because it really is this mockery of Job's civilization. Like, you think of your city as this wonderful, civilized, cultured place, and the wild animal laughs and says, that's the last place I'd ever want to be, that noisy city that you have. I get to roam free out on the plains. Yesur Harim Mir Ehu, sentence 8. Yesur Harim Mir Ehu, the grass that grows on the mountains, that's where this animal grazes. Yesur, they take like latur by the Meraglim to spy out. So that which it spies out on the mountains, that's where it grazes. Ve'achar kol yarok yidrosh, and it seeks everything green. That's the wild donkey. from which he shifts to talk about the wild ox, but still within the theme of the wild animal and the untamed character of it. This is great. It's like a National Geographic special. The Yitzchak Lahamon Kiri. I'm sorry, I read that already. Pasuk Tet, sentence 9. Hayover Reim of Decha. Tell me something, Job. Will the Reim serve you? You may be familiar with this as Re'im, as it's often written, with the middle letter as an aleph instead of a yud, right? Re'im. The Re'im is a mighty wild animal generally rendered as an ox. Is that what they do in the art scroll? I haven't been tracking. Yeah, wild ox. So, Hayover Reim of Decha. Will the ox serve you? This wild ox? Im yalin al Abu Secha. Al Abu Secha, will it lie down by your trough? Hatikshor Reim b'selam aboso. Do you tie the reim, the wild ox, to the furrow with your rope? Im yisadeid amakim acharecha, is it going to plow the valleys for you? You know, give it a shot, Job. Can you? You know, is this something you can do? Hasivtach bo ki rav kocho. Can you trust in the strength of this creature and leave your work for it? Can you do that? Can you trust it to bring in your seed for you? And to harvest in your grain. Good luck with the wild ox, Job. Yeah, and this again, to me, it doesn't seem like it's about divine might as much as it's just saying there's so much of the world that you have nothing to do with, Job. It's just not, it's not your realm. You don't take care of it. You don't know from it. And here we get to, as they I think they translate here, I saw the ox reference, they translate this as the ostrich in the next sentence. Knap Rinanim, most commentaries that I saw render this as an ostrich, even though we've used another word for ostrich elsewhere in the book. Here we're going to use this term, and I want to ask that question of why we use this term in a moment. But first let's see what he says about the ostrich in this sentence. He says, "Knaf rinanim ne'elasa." The knaf rinanim. What does knaf rinanim literally mean? Wings of. What are rinanim?
Song.
Song, right? It's usually like a joyous song. It's a happy song. Rananu tzadikim. That, yeah. The knaf rinanim, the wings of this creature, which is known as the creature of joyous song, ne'elasa. What is ne'elasa? There's a word like it, but you have to switch the samach to the zayin. Right? Which is? Alizan, and so on. What does it mean? Right.
Joy.
Something that rejoices, that's happy. Knaf rinanim ne'elasa. The ostrich with its beautiful wings of song is joyous. In Evracha Sida Benotza, which is a very hard set, the second half of the sentence is difficult. I'm going to take it Rashi's way, that it's a list of three birds. The Evracha Sida and Notza. There are other ways to take it, but I'm focusing for the moment on the first half of this. It's the joy of the ostrich. How was the ostrich used earlier in the book? Anybody remember?
Ya'ana,
right? And how? What was the reference? It's like chidon. No, we talked about, as I recall, and now I'm looking for it, but as I recall, we talked about the mournful sound of the ostrich. Wasn't it in Perek Lamed? I believe it was in Perek Lamed in chapter 30 that we referred to it when he was talking about the ruins that he now lives in. All right, if I find it later... Oh, there it is. Yes, chapter 30, sentence 29. It was in, there was another reference besides this one, but the point is, and the reason why I single this out is because we referred to the Ya'ana earlier, the ostrich earlier, in terms of the mournful sound that it makes in the desert. The way it even frightens people at night. Right? I think I even put a link on the sheets to a YouTube video where you could actually catch the sound of the mournful sound the ostrich makes. Here, he's not talking about the ostrich as mournful. He's talking about the ostrich rejoicing, and so he uses a different name for it, the name that highlights these joyous feathers of the ostrich. I should note, there is one view that I saw, Mitzudat David suggests it's actually a peacock, which is a nice image with the feathers, but everybody else... It says it's an ostrich, so it's not that it loses on this one. But the point is, you have this joyous, wild bird. It's a bird that lives off in the wild, and it doesn't rely, once again, on human beings. And so he continues in sentence 14, Kisa'azov la'aretz beitzeha. She leaves her eggs out on the ground. V'ala far techamein. And on the ground, she will warm them, or she will go warm herself on the ground, ignoring the eggs, either way. Vatishkach ki regel tizurah, she forgets that feet could come along and trample the eggs. Vechayas hasadet tidusheha, and that the animals could come along and crush them. In other words, the ostrich has not a care in the world, lays the eggs, leaves the eggs on the ground, and wanders away. And once again, I didn't look it up. I didn't look up the ornithology on this to see whether ostriches, you know, in our familiarity do it. Sorry? Yeah, what do they say?
Let's get to the court. Okay. Now, the ostrich is polygamous, and several hens deposit their eggs in one place in a whole street. The eggs are then covered over and left during the heat of the day. But in the colder regions, at any rate, as in the center, the birds sit regularly during the night and until the sun has full power, the male also incubates. But the ostrich lays an immense number of eggs, far more than ever hatched, and round the covered eggs are to be found. Many drop carelessly, as if she forgot that the frost might crack them before the wild beast might break.
Okay.
Most naturalists, for the statement of the natives, that the eggs on the surface are left in order to afford sustenance to the newly hatched chicks, which could not otherwise find food at first in their arid region.
That's terrible. I didn't want to hear that.
Look at you asking me that.
Yes. Okay, Shana.
Well, I remember that in Echad is the reference to the women who are cruel to their children. They're
exactly. But the, right. There, you have the more mournful aspect of it. That's why you don't use the term kanaf renanim, but rather b'nat yana. Good. So, kayenim bamidbar. Batamil achzar kayenim bamidbar. Good. So so he continues here. Sentence 16. Hikshiach baneha lilo la. She forgets the young. They're going to go to somebody else. Lerik yigiyah balifachad. She leaves her work for nothing, without any fear. Ki hisha eloka chochma, because God has caused her to forget her wisdom. Velo chalakla babina. He didn't give her a. Yes. So the ostrich has no understanding. Pasuk Yichet, sentence 18. Kais bamarom tamri. At some point, it's going to fly up to the heavens, tischak lasus ulrochvo, and it laughs at the horse and rider, right? Much like in the previous segment, the donkey laughed at civilization, so the ostrich laughs at the horse and rider. So what you see here is, first we talked about the fact that the human being isn't needed to feed these animals. Then we said the human being isn't needed to raise the young. And third, the animals do very well off in the wild, even the animals that don't have any seichel, the animals that don't know what they're doing, yeah, they get by. Nonetheless, they manage. And now, we take the horse image. Pasuk Yutet, sentence 19. Humans pride themselves on the horses of war. So look what's here. Hasitein lasus givura. Do you give the horse strength? Hasalbish Savaro Rama, are you the one who clothes the neck of the horse in thunder, meaning in thunderous noise? Hasari Shenu Karbe, do you cause it to make noise like locusts when the horses go racing across the field? Hod Nachro Ema, the glory of its nostrils intimidating. Yachbaruva Emek, They dig in the valley, meaning as they run with their, as they gallop with their hooves. So the hooves are digging holes in the valley. V'yasis bekoach, and they thrill in their strength. Yetzei likras noshek, they go out to greet the weapons on the other side. There's a fearless quality to the horse. Yischak lefachad velo yechas, it laughs. There's that image once again of laughter, right? That's our third image of laughter for those keeping score at home. The horse laughs at fear. Velo yechas, it will not tremble. Velo yashuv mipnei chariv, it will not turn back due to the sword. Alav tirne ashfa lav chanit vikidon. On it, meaning on top of the horse, the ashpa is the quiver that has the arrows in it. So the quiver trembles and sings. I guess it's really a singing reference. The on top of the horse, the lahav, the blade of chanit v'kidon, the sword, the lance. Birash viroges yegame aretz, in noise. In turmoil, it makes holes in the ground, yigamet, like gumot, holes. Velo ya'amin ki kol shofar. That's also a very hard phrase to render, and the commentators take it in different directions. The art scroll takes it as, he cannot believe it when the horn sounds. That doesn't explain a lot. So, I see here in their notes, they brought you Rashi's approach, which is, it can't believe its good fortune when it's summoned to war. Like, oh yes, the shofar went, let's go! That's the way that Rashi takes it. Mitzudat David takes it differently, saying it's not scared of the sound of the shofar. Meaning, when the horn is blown, that signals the enemy is coming, and everybody is afraid, and the horse, careless. You can do what you want. The horse has its own strength, and it will go on its own. Now, once you involve it in war, that means there is a human being around. This is not an animal living off in the wild. What he's saying is that its strength is native to it. The strength, the fearlessness, that's not because of human beings. This is the way horses are. And so he says, "Bidei shofar yomar he'ach." When the shofar blows, it cries he'ach. He'ach is like ra, you know, let's go. That type of
It says hooray.
Hooray, yeah, hooray. Umerachok yariach milchama. From afar it smells war. Ram sarim utrua, the thunder of the officers, the thunder of the trumpeting. That's what concludes his discussion of the horse of war. And then he turns to two birds, the nates and the nesher. So the nates we tend to render, I think, as a hawk. They do it here as a hawk. They translate nesher here as eagle. Again, I believe the correct translation is indeed vulture. It's based on the fact that Rashi on the Gemara, when he talks about the signs of kosher and non-kosher birds, describes the foot of the nesher in a way that doesn't fit eagles in terms of the placement of the toes. And what he describes fits, in fact, the vulture, which fits the context of the birds it's mentioned with in the Chumash. So vulture seems to be correct. And I think I've mentioned before, the reason why we're so reluctant to say vulture is because God describes himself in the beginning of Parashat Yisro carrying us away on the wings of Nisharim. And no one wants to ride the wings of vultures. We'd much rather ride the wings of eagles. So I think I mentioned it in some class that the Sansino Chumash, I believe, on the psukim like this one, and in Parashat Shmini, it will translate it as vulture. But in Parshas Yisro, when it talks about us being on the wings of, it renders it as eagles.
Are you just relying on Rashi, or are there other commentators that do the same?
Well, the problem is that Rashi's statement is relied on in terms of defining the symbols of kosher and non-kosher birds. So it's not just him, but a whole school. And the secular school certainly takes it as vulture. They have no problem with the vulture idea. So is there someone who translates it differently regarding the arrangement of the clause? Could be. Possible. Yes?
A griffin.
A griffin. I don't know. They don't have them at the Toronto Zoo. Griffin. Okay. No, that's a hippogriff. Two different things. Get your Potter right. Okay. So the Pasuk Chavav, sentence 26. You have to have kids of the right age. We shift to talk about birds, and we have these two wild birds. And here, it's not going to speak to what a human being does. It's not going to talk about, as we did before, taming the creatures and feeding the creatures. That's not what he's going to focus on here. Instead, we're going to get this really jarring image to conclude the speech. Hami bi nascha yaver nates. Is it through your wisdom that the hawk flies? Yifros kinafav l'seiman, it will spread its wings to the south. Im al picha yagbi anasher, is it at your word that the nesher will fly way up? V'chi yarim kino, and it will raise up its nest. If you think of the pasuk, kinesher yair kino, right, at the end of Chumash Devarim, same reference there, raising up its nest. Sela yishkon v'yislonan, it lives away in the boulder. Al shein sela umitsuda, on the tooth of the rock, jutting out. Misham chafar ochel, from there it digs out dirt. From there it digs out food. Lemerachok einav yabitu, its eyes see far away. Ve'efrochav ya'alaudam uva'asher chalalim sham hu. Its chicks ye'alau dam. One of the commentators, I forget which one, takes the word ye'alau and says that it's an onomatopoeia. Right? It means to swallow. So, ya'alu, especially with the original way to render an ayin, the guttural sound, ya'alu, is actually a reference to swallowing. So, its young swallow blood, and wherever there are chalalim, chalalim are corpses, there it will be. What kind of a corpse is a chalal? Human corpses. In other words, the ultimate image of the triumph of the wild over the human being. The wild is going to outlive you. You think you're this dominant species controlling the planet. They have their own existence. Frankly, I am supporting them. They laugh at your civilization. They don't need what you provide. And long after human beings are corpses, they're just going to be swallowing the blood. It's this very harsh image at the end, and it seals the speech. God has said now what he needs to say to Job. The key message is, you and I, Job, live in different worlds. Now, I did say, and this I think is what you were talking about, Susan, I was going to come back to certain thoughts. So, number one, Moish asked the question about the whirlwind. God speaks to Job from within the whirlwind. However, didn't God say to Eliyahu, I am not in the wind? Didn't he say that to Elijah? So it's important to distinguish between two words, se'ara and ruach. Se'ara is the term that's used here, which we rendered whirlwind, or there were, I think, a couple of other translations. And ruach, of course, is wind as well. But ruach is forceful and destructive. Se'ara is blinding, something you can't see through. If you go back for a second to Job chapter 1, sentence 19, it is a ruach that destroys the house, not a se'ara. It's a ruach that destroys the house. That's the agent of force. If you take a look, don't even look at that verse, there's a different one that's more important to see. Malachim Aleph, Kings 1. Chapter 19. This is the story of Eliyahu with God. Remember the context for it. Eliyahu runs away because they want to kill him. Right? Jezebel wants to kill him. It's page 863. No, I'm sorry. Page 861. He runs away and he protests to God. God says to him, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? And Eliyahu rages against the people. He says, Kano kinesi l'Hashem, I have been outraged for you, God. The people have violated the covenant. I am the only good one left, and they want to kill me. And then you get the image in sentence 11, in which God says to him, go out and stand on a mountain. And lo and behold, there is a powerful wind smashing mountains, breaking rocks, and he is told, God is not in the wind. The term there is ruach, not se'ara. Ruach is that which is dangerous. It is force, it is rage, and one way that this story is understood in general is that God is saying to Elijah, enough with the anger. I don't need you as my prophet to be angry. That's the wrong approach right now. Yeah, you can understand anger. They want to kill him. But nonetheless, God says that's not the right approach. And finally, he's in what they translate usually as the still small voice. Yes, Leah?
So it's Ruach Hashem. Ruach Hashem because Hashem has the two sides of spirit and power?
Potentially. Could be. Could be. We do use the term, even in the beginning of the Chumash. Ruach Elokim, Ruach Hebed al Pnei Amayim. We have that. You're right. But the statement that he makes to Job is to Eliyahu is, I don't want you to be forceful, I don't want you to be angry. The message that God gives to Job, on the other hand, in his speech here, is not an angry speech. We spent 2 weeks looking at this first speech of God. Did we see any anger? Did God ever say to Job, I am angry at you for the way you have spoken? He's more amused than anything else. I don't get any vibe of anger. There was no expression of anger in anything that he said. It's not a speech of ruach. What it is a speech of se'ara, in the sense that it's coming from a place that is opaque, that is confusing, that Job can't see into. Which we do find in the story of Eliyahu, the story of Elijah. If you go a little bit further to Malachim Bet, Kings 2, when God retires Eliyahu. Chapter 2, sentence 11, it's page 879. When he is taken up to heaven, or wherever it is that he goes anyway. So, you get the classic chariot of fire, right? And what does he go up in? Se'ara. And Elisha can't see him. The vision is obscured. Elisha can't see him. So, God is not wrathful here. He's not ruach. But he is se'ara. He's inscrutable. You can't figure out what he's doing, which is, you know, part of the message that he's trying to convey. I gave you the references on your sheet. It's all on your sheet in source number 5. So you can always use that as your reference. That was one piece that I wanted to come back to. The second piece that I wanted to come back to is chapter 38, sentence 13. Chapter 38, sentence 13, and I'm doing this more quickly than it deserves. You see the letter ayin in the word Rishaim? And how it's elevated above the line. You see it in 13, and then again you see it in 15. You see it? So it appears twice here that you have an ayin that is elevated. It was chapter 38, sentence 13. It's page 1671 if you're using, well, you'd have to see it on the Hebrew side, in the art scroll. So there are two there. There's another one in Tehillim in Psalms. I gave you the references in source number 6, so you can look them up when you wish. But there's an ayin that's suspended in Tehillim, and then there's a nun that's suspended in Shoftim. So the critics will look at it and say, clearly this was scribal annotation. In other words, they had a problem. They thought there should be an ayin, they weren't sure if there should be an ayin, so they put in the ayin, but they hung it a little bit above to leave it that way. Which I find funny, but for a whole host of reasons, I find it difficult. The Talmud itself is bothered by it too, but it does what you would expect the Talmud to do with it. Which is that it says the word has two meanings. One, if you read it as Rasha, and one if you read it as rush, and that the text is hedging its bets by including both, because including rush could be reading it with the word rush could be offensive to some. And I'm not going into the source, but I brought it for you in source number 7 in order for you to be able to see it. We just don't have the time to go through it and still learn Job. So that's the sacrifice. But I brought it on the sheet if you want to see what the Talmud does with it. Sentence 13 and sentence 15 in chapter 38. The The next note that I wanted to just show you, at least, was that in chapter 38, sentence 14, we talked about God turning things like the dirt with a seal, where you imprint the dirt with the seal, and it'll make a it'll make an impression. So I had to note for you source number 8, in which the Talmud comments on that each human being is minted with the seal of Adam HaRishon, meaning that we're all supposed to be descendants of Adam and Chava, and yet none of us resemble each other. And so this is the image of God creating life, and each one is different, like the dirt beneath the seal, except that usually when you stamp everything with the same seal, it'll all look the same. And here it's Tid HaPeich, it all changes. Each one looks different, even though they're coming from the same place. Blame it on RNA recombination. But that's the image that the Talmud is picking up on. We're all minted, but Tid HaPeich, we nonetheless all change. The last point that I wanted to make sure to show you was when he said in chapter 38, sentence 15, that God hides the light from the wicked. And that is one of the two bases for a popular midrash, which you've heard at some point for sure. The original light of creation, what happened to it? It was hidden away. How do we know there was original light to creation at all? It's explicit in the Chumash. In the first day, it says there was light, but he didn't create the sun and the stars until day 4. So you have 3 days when there's light coming from somewhere. So that tells me there was light that is gone now. But it doesn't tell me what happened to it. So you're probably familiar with the Midrash, it's in the Gemara in source number 9, that God hid it away because of the wicked. Where did the Gemara get that idea? I understand where the Gemara gets the idea that there was light to begin with. But how do you know that that's why God hid it away? The answer is chapter 38, sentence 15 in Job, in which it says, God hid the light from the wicked. So what that midrash is doing is it's coupling together verses from Bereshit, from Genesis, with verses from Job in order to draw its conclusion. You follow? That's what the midrash is doing. It's brilliant. But, okay. Those were just a couple of the points that I wanted to follow up on from those chapters. So we've seen the demand for communication from Job. We've seen God respond to Job by saying, you don't understand, in different forms, and you don't have the role that you think you have, and I am not going to communicate with you. This communication is simply not possible, that which you expect. And by the way, I wrote into my notes here, and it's worth mentioning, we do find God communicate with human beings. He gives commands, right? Starting with Adam and Chava, he says, don't eat from the fruit. It may not have taken, but he did. He did communicate. We find prophecy. But there's a difference between those types of communication and what Job is looking for. Right? Job is not looking for instructions. Job is not looking for warnings of repent or punishment is coming. What Job is looking for is explanation. And that's the type of communication that God is saying, it ain't coming. So that's worth understanding. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 8. The clock resets on that when I restart the thing. We have 3 minutes. Okay. So we'll just mention what the themes are at any rate for where we're going. God is going to turn to Job in the beginning of this chapter and say, Job, I want you to answer me. That's what I want from you. I want you to tell me, now that you've heard what I have to say, I want you to respond. And Job is sort of going to mumble and say, no further questions, Your Honor. More or less. But it's not going to satisfy God for reasons that we're going to have to explore. And so God is going to come back to him with another speech in which he's going to talk about the behemoth and the leviathan. I never realized until reading this where the word behemoth really comes from, in the sense that it's behemot. It's a literal translation of the word behemot. Rather than take behemot as a plural word, which is what my instinct would have been, animals, right? Behemot becomes behemoth. I understand also it was one of the final words on the, one one of the final questions on the Chidona Tanakh was actually about this. And the person who answered the question wrong chose the wrong one between Behemoth and Leviathan. They should have been here for the Eosh. They would have gotten it. But God is going to send a message to Job by speaking of these two mighty creatures. He's still not angry. You still won't find divine anger here, but what you're going to find is the gap between God's field of experience and Job's field of experience. But instead of having many brief images, like you just saw, where you had two sentences or four sentences about a particular creature, the entire speech is going to focus on these two super creatures. And what we're going to need to ask ourselves is, what is Job's answer to God? And what is God adding with his second speech? And why are these two creatures in particular singled out for a longer treatment? So that's what we'll have to do, God willing, next week. We are still on track to complete the week before Shavuot and to have, God willing, a siyum of some kind to celebrate the day after Shavuot. Thank you very much.